Good morning, everyone. I hope you can hear me all right. I'm using a different computer now, than I usually use for these meetings. It seems to be operating okay. So, as you know, this is one of our weekly office hours in the course on patent law and global public health. As usual, I am happy to take any questions, either presented in person or in the chat, concerning any aspect of the course. As you probably all recognize by now, we have made a significant shift in our focus. The first 7 weeks of the course was all about patent law, and now, the last 2 weeks, just beginning the third week, we've been focused on public health. The materials for the coming week represent the greatest point of convergence of the topics, because we will be examining details of patent law and its relationship to possible solutions of the global health crisis. So, anybody have questions? Peter.
Hello, Professor. I had a question about the exercise that we did, the negotiation exercise that we did for the week.
Yep.
One of the assumptions in the exercise was that the patents will not expire for at least 10 years and would survive challenges to their validity. I was wondering what the effect might be if we did not make those assumptions, there was a possibility that it could be invalidated, which is I suppose the realistic situation, and how the parties might behave if that were a possibility.
So you're right in pointing out that when creating that exercise, I tried to make it as realistic as possible. So I selected a real disease and a real new drug and some real companies. But I also inserted some simplifying assumptions in order not to overload the exercise with complexity. And you focused on one important simplifying assumption, namely the strength of the intellectual property rights at issue. Strength both in the sense of how long they're going to last and their likelihood to stand up to a challenge. So first, let me say a little bit more about that. Although, as I mentioned, one of the previous lectures, the rate at which pharmaceutical product patents fall when challenged, typically on non-obviousness or novelty grounds, occasionally on enablement grounds, is about 50%. That number is misleading because it implies that half of pharmaceutical product patents are invalid, whereas in fact, there's a strong bias in the sample because it only includes the ones that are challenged and not the patents that the potential challengers conclude are strong. And that's especially true with respect to monoclonal antibodies because they are very new. And so long as they're engineered, meaning that they are not distillations of naturally occurring substances, they're likely to be quite strong. The patents on them are likely to be quite strong. And so so that assumption, although simplifying, doesn't simplify a whole lot. Okay, so let's imagine that we were dealing, just to zero in what I take to be the substance of your question, let's imagine we were dealing with a more conventional small molecule drug, And it's in a me too position, so that it is definitely more vulnerable to a non-obviousness challenge. How would that alter the exercise? Well, one way it would change things actually implicates an issue that we're going to be considering, or you'll be considering in the seminars this week, namely how threats by a developing government, developing country governments, or generic firms can be used as leverage in negotiating for a voluntary license. So as you're going to see in this coming week, it's reasonably common, at least was until recently, reasonably common for countries to initiate invocations of compulsory licensing proceedings, but not to press them to conclusion because they extract a voluntary license along the way, which has advantages over a compulsory license. And a challenge to the validity of a patent, or a threat to challenge the validity of a patent, is another potential source of leverage. So bring this around to a nub. The weaker the patent at issue in a negotiation, the more leverage the potential licensee and the developing country government have to extract concessions during the negotiation. Good question. Okay, others? J.M.
Good morning, Professor. Good to see you. It's not quite a question, but it's more of a discussion topic, which relates to, it's quite common or normal for pharmaceutical firms to register several trademarks before approval of a patent. However, trademarks and its use is not allowed till marketing authorization and clinical trials are successful. There are lots of opposition to such registrations, and many of the pharmaceutical firms, they registered several trademarks for the same drug, either in color, shape, packaging, with the intention to prolong the patent duration and the commercialization. And then there are oppositions to that. So I would like to hear if there are some special concepts or recent cases coming out of the legal judgments to such incidents in US, if you can share with me today.
Yeah, that's a very interesting issue. You're correct, certainly, that trademark law provides two ways of strengthening the commercial position of a pharmaceutical firm. One is it helps to extend the effective life of exclusivity. And the second is it facilitates differential pricing. So let's focus on the first one for a moment. A key factor here is that in the US, and even more so in Europe and Japan, for example, patients are largely shielded from making price judgments as to drugs, meaning that in most insurance regimes, they don't bear significantly higher costs if the prescription is for a innovator version versus a generic. And When you add that fact, the price insensitivity of most consumers, to the power of a trademark and a trade dress to convey a reputation of reliability, it means that patients consistently put pressure upon both doctors and insurance companies to prolong the reliance on the innovator and to delay shifts to the generic. And so definitely one of the strategies and effective strategies of pharmaceutical firms when mitigating a patent cliff is to ride the reputation generated by the trademark and the trade dress, the color, packaging, and so forth, as long as possible. And it's largely that phenomenon that explains the slow decline in the price of the innovator drugs and the volume sold after the end of the patent. And as we discussed a couple of weeks ago, it doesn't go to zero quickly. It's a slope like this. And much of that slope is related to this combination of price insensitivity by consumers on the one hand and the power of trademarks on the other. Okay, so the other respect in which, as your comment rightly indicates, trademark protection is very effective is setting up opportunities for differential pricing. For example, as Clifford Samuel explained, and as you may have discussed in the negotiation exercise last week, it is reasonably common for firms willing to enter into voluntary licenses in developing countries to both grant a license to a generic firm, but also to have their own brand, so-called branded generic, in the market at the same time. Sometimes in order to make money, sometimes more altruistically in order to discipline the prices of the generics by in effect capping the prices that the generics can charge. So the ability to do that is enhanced if you have a variety of trademarks in hand, not just one, so that you can employ one for the innovator and, you know, a completely different name and color and so forth for the generic, creating these levels. It's, you know, it's like Lexus and Toyota, it's, you know, the same strategy. So now you asked the question, are there, that's all by way of background to fill in what's undoubtedly familiar to you, but maybe less familiar to the other participants in the course. So you asked the question, are there any recent decisions in the United States limiting this? So the short answer is not that I know of. There is a longstanding issue in the United States that periodically pops up in litigation concerning the question of functionality. Standard way of attacking trademarks and above all trade dress in the pharmaceutical field is to argue that it is functional. And this is a general defense to trademark protection, functional in the sense that stability of colors, this is the most common version of the argument, is important to enable elderly patients keep track of their multiple prescriptions over time. And therefore it's to permit an innovator to monopolize, say, a color or a shape would allow recognition and enforcement of a functional trademark, which is what we're not supposed to be doing with trademark law. So this is a common line of attack, and sometimes it succeeds and sometimes it doesn't, but it's not new. It's been around for a while, and it's a, you know, a front of continuing struggle. So so the bottom line is nothing that I'm aware of that's new in this area, and in the U.S. anyway. And the net result is that, to return to the general theme, trademark protection functions as a extender of patent protection and a facilitator of differential pricing, but not forever.
Thank you. Thank you, Paulson.
You're welcome. Other questions? Mateo.
Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Thank you for your time. I was wondering how countries like mine that are involved in bilateral agreements with United States and another developed countries, how can we deal with those agreements? How we can modify them? Because you already said that those agreements hold our patent and also IP system, because there are some directions that we have to follow. How countries like mine, Colombia, that don't have a lot of bargaining power can deal with those agreements? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a tough question. So as you know, probably you know all along, but as I also mentioned in the recorded lecture for this coming week, Colombia is one of the countries that has a free trade agreement with the US. And it is one of the agreements that does, in some significant way, limit Colombia's freedom to exercise the otherwise existing TRIPS flexibilities. So it creates a problem. Peru also has such an agreement, and Ecuador is negotiating one. CAFTA in Central America, a regional agreement, also limits some TRIPS flexibilities. So there are two issues here. One is how to reduce the likelihood of provisions of this sort being included in a trade agreement, meaning this is water over the dam for Colombia, but many other developing countries are in the position of negotiating, and not just with the United States, it's even more commonly with the EU, negotiating these agreements. Well, as you point out, very often the developing country in those negotiations doesn't have a lot of bargaining power, especially if they're isolated. You know, if they're not bargaining as a group, they're individual. But they definitely have some. So they're not powerless. And seemingly technical issues can be, the countries in question can resist if they're aware of the significance of them. So for instance, the language in some agreements concerning obligations to extend data exclusivity protection to innovator drugs. Sometimes those provisions say, you know, to protect against unfair commercial use, a vague and easily evaded restriction. And sometimes they say, well, that's presumptively 5 years. That's much harder to evade. And the inclusion or lack thereof of that clause can make a big difference. In some instances, developing countries don't see, the negotiators on behalf of the developing countries don't see how important a seemingly innocuous phrase of that sort can be. And if they see it and resist at the threshold, they can sometimes prevent it from being included. So this isn't a great deal of reassurance. And increasingly now the negotiators for developing countries are sophisticated. So this isn't a hugely innovative comment, but step number one is be aware of the hazard that these seemingly technical provisions can create and resist them to the extent that's feasible in the negotiation. That's step one. That's the first branch. Second branch is, what about a country like Colombia that is already subject to a free trade agreement? Is there anything that can be done to mitigate its impacts? To explain this in detail would require going needlessly far into the lecture for this coming week, but so I'll just state it in general terms. The language of the free trade agreements, like the language of several provisions of TRIPS, is not crystal clear. There's room for interpretation. And with appropriate media attention, the developing countries can press for more favorable interpretations than the developed countries would want. The clearest example of that historically is the stubbornness of South Africa in on arguing for interpretations of Article 31. Now, this was a long time ago, but it worked, meaning that by pressing for a favorable to South Africa interpretation of Article 31 and sustaining attention to the impact of that issue on the prevalence of AIDS in the country, eventually South Africa prevailed. So identifying a point of ambiguity, pressing for a favorable interpretation, and keeping the issue visible for long enough to bring political pressure to bear can work. It worked in South Africa, it worked in Brazil, it sort of worked in Thailand, not super well. So that would be the second of two suggestions.
But do you think that could be retaliations from those countries or those deference from those countries? Because right now, the Amazon indigenous people, they are facing pharmaceuticals going there and looking for the plants and the traditional knowledge. And through that bilateral agreement, they can do that. They can patent medicines that are from indigenous people of Amazon. But I think Colombia is a special case because our economy depends a lot of United States. So I don't know if trying to challenge or at least interpretate the agreement for our side, I don't know if that could hit in our economy. We could be banned or something like that. That's the pressure that we are dealing right now.
I'm afraid you're correct that Colombia has nowhere near the population and the economic power that South Africa and Brazil, for example, had. And so they are not in as strong a position. That's certainly true. But you also introduced one other theme that we have not yet talked about in the course, but it does matter for Colombia, which is the rules governing the development of pharmaceutical products relying on indigenous groups' knowledge of genetic sequences. This does indeed implicate, all the countries of tropical Latin America have, most of them, have access to biological resources that are valuable to the pharmaceutical firms. And that potentially gives them more leverage. The leverage there is enhanced by the Nagoya Protocol, to which I'm pretty sure Colombia is a party now. All of the countries of the EU are also parties to the Nagoya Protocol. The US is not. And so leverage against the EU, against the US, relying on the Nagoya Protocol is on its face weak. But pharmaceutical firms routinely now instruct their researchers when harvesting either information or biological resources in tropical countries to comply with the Nagoya Protocol, because they don't want their the fruits of the research to be vulnerable challenge in the EU. So even though the US is not a party here, the Nagoya Protocol is an important lever that can be employed to extract concessions from the pharmaceutical firms. Well, what kind of concessions? Well, the traditional form of concession is money. But in my view, that's actually not the most useful way of extracting concessions in return for access to biological materials. Much more important is access to the pharmaceutical products that might be generated through the use of that knowledge at affordable prices. That's a much bigger gain. Okay, so let me say one last word on this, or too long an answer, but it's raised a lot of important questions. The other issue is, let's imagine, to simplify things radically, that Colombia were able to insist as a condition of access to the biological resources in the Amazon that any drugs produced through the use of that knowledge were available at affordable prices in Colombia. Does Colombia have a moral or political obligation to include, when bargaining for such things, Peru or Bolivia or Central America? Well, you see the issue. Does one act on behalf of a group of similarly situated countries, or do you, when negotiating such things, act on behalf of one's own government alone? That's a hard question.
And also another issue arises that you put a traditional knowledge that is a kind of IP and patent law. So we are prevailing the patent law that is the private law instead of the traditional knowledge of people, indigenous people.
Yeah, that's true. And that's what one of the reasons why the Nagoya Protocol is so important, because it elevates traditional knowledge as well as more importantly, the biological resource to which the traditional knowledge usually is applied into the level of an intellectual property right. Now, I should emphasize here, it's a weird intellectual property right in two respects. Yeah. One is it's community-based rather than individual. And second, it lasts forever, unlike all other intellectual property rights, with the possible exception of trademarks. So it is an odd one, but the significance of bringing it up into the galaxy of intellectual property rights is to empower the holders of it. A recurring theme here, probably obvious, is that in most circumstances, the best way to make use of that intellectual property right is to use it as a lever when bargaining for benefits, rather than to assert it as a form of monopoly power.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. David.
Thank you, Professor, and good hello, everyone. My question relates to the article fostering production of pharmaceutical products in developing countries that you, Professor, together with the other scholars, wrote, which formed part of the materials for last week. Now, in the article, you identify production triangles together with RECs. These are the regional economic communities as part of mechanisms that could be used to foster production of pharmaceutical products. So I am based in Nairobi, Kenya, and I found this to be quite interesting to me. Now, what I would like you to comment upon is, because you have discussed in the context of production triangles. You gave the example of Cipla, that is the India famous pharmaceutical company that did some work in Uganda. I would like to know, in the context of regional economic communities, can we have this arrangement of production triangles such that it is now not within one nation, like the Cipla Uganda example, but for a group of nations, for example, like the COMESA region, for example, or the SADC region? So if you could kindly comment on that, I'll be much grateful, and thank you in advance for your answer. Thank you.
So David, that's a very nice summary of a theme that you're right. I, along with my co-authors, Ruth and Padmasri, emphasized in that article. And you are also correct in highlighting the potential power of a regional economic community like ECOWAS or SADC in occupying one corner of the triangle. To my knowledge, there are not yet any good examples of the exercise of that power. There are, of course, regional purchasing practices, but not a triangular licensing arrangement of the kind discussed in the article when one of the corners is represented by a regional organization. So why not? Well, part of the trouble here is that there are within each of the regional organizations, definitely in Africa, you can think of, roughly speaking, political challenges to getting everyone into alignment. So you know this better than I do, but in every one of those organizations, there will be large and economically dominant countries and less powerful countries. You know, so in ECOWAS it would be Nigeria, and SADC will be South Africa, and so forth. So that plus, in some instances, a long-standing historical tensions among the countries impede collaboration. It's one of the reasons why the African Medicines Agency is taking a long time to get off the ground, because even though it's formally authorized on paper, actually implementation is difficult in the face of the tensions. So the principal challenge to implementation of the recommendation in that article is overcoming those impediments. Let me just add one more detail here. As I suggested in the article, the principle of local production, very important principle increasingly now in our field, has an ambiguity in it, which is, what does local mean? And in particular, does local mean that the drugs in question have to be manufactured in the country in question, or is it sufficient to manufacture them in the region in question? So not all of the triangle arrangements involve local production of APIs, but let's assume optimistically they do. Then the issue is, where is that plant going to be located? This is not trivial, because not only is it a matter of pride, but it's also a matter of jobs and technical training and capacity building and so forth. And so there has been historically in every one of these regional organizations, a tendency for the largest and economically most powerful country to insist upon locating manufacturing capabilities there. And there's, you know, it's not crazy that, after all, they usually are farther ahead technologically. But that means that the other countries in the region lose out on one of the main advantages of local production. So figuring out some way consistent with economies of scale to share the benefits of localization of production further complicates the task of overcoming political barriers. Okay, so that's that. I've tried to answer your question. What would have to be done in order to succeed on this front? Those are the two challenges, in my view. They're related. But the benefits of regional collaboration in this particular area are so large that I'm hopeful that sooner or later they can be overcome.
Thank you.
Okay. Pablo.
Good morning for everyone. Thank you for your time, Professor Fisher. I have three questions. First, what is the proposal for tightening patentability requirements? I mean, we have two options. First, the inventive step requirement that is imposed by TRIPS agreement. And in the class of this week, you reflexive about the capacity of Brazil, for example, between the negotiation of a inventive step and, for example, in the US is a non-obvious. What are the negotiation around the comprehension of non-obviousness and inventive step inside their difference that are significant in United States? Second, when we talk about the taking clause, this is a federal United States option that you clarified. But I think, and you reflected in this case for is hypothetical or is a theoretical manner of be possible. And you put the example of the reduction of the protection of patent inside the 20 years for 15 years. That is the item with the Article 1 of the National Constitution of United States, or is about the public interest, about the welfare theory? And third, as you, with the discussion with Mateo, what are you thinking about the Bonn Declaration? Because with this declaration, the international community that recognized the traditional knowledge of indigenous people negotiate the searching, research, deposit of the traditional knowledge. But what is the conflict between the patent law and the traditional knowledge inside this declaration? And have to take a point that the WIPO established with the EGG, that is the Genetic Resource Committee, that established the public domain and the debate with copyright topics. Thank you, Professor.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll take them up in order. Most often, when one discusses TRIPS flexibilities, meaning the discretion retained by countries to adjust their patent laws to address health needs. The premier examples are compulsory licensing options under Article 31 and Article 31 bis, and parallel importation under tacitly permitted by Article 6. Those are by far the most commonly invoked of the TRIPS flexibilities, and most of the literature in this field focuses on them. One of the things I tried to do in that, in the recorded lecture for this coming week, is to highlight other aspects of the TRIPS agreement that contain less well-known or completely unknown flexibilities. And you remind us collectively here of two of them, both involving tightening patentability requirements. So the nothing in the TRIPS agreement says a country, member country of the World Trade Organization, can define inventive step or enablement as it wishes. It doesn't say that. But it doesn't say the opposite either. It just says inventions capable of industrial application and having an inventive step shall be patentable. So that means that the countries have some significant latitude in interpreting those terms. And if there are any doubt on that score, that doubt is removed by studying the history of those doctrines in developed countries, including the United States. So what you have done helpfully here is highlight one of the reasons why this course is structured the way it is, namely 7 weeks of patent law before we get to public health, is so that you have a reasonably, not completely, but reasonably detailed knowledge of how patent law has evolved over time and where the soft places are. So to remind you, back in module 104, I showed you how radically different the inventive step requirement has been interpreted over time in the United States and as between different countries. Used to be very high in China, is now coming down. Used to be very low in the United Kingdom, is now coming up. The United States has gone up and down and up and down. And against that backdrop, the argument occasionally made by some scholars that inventive step has a firm meaning that developing countries have no authority to deviate from makes no sense, because the developed countries have long been adjusting this standard up and down and continue to do so. So at a minimum, the amount of latitude that has been manifested historically in the interpretation of this is available to developing countries now as a matter of interpretation of the TRIPS agreement. And countries should use that flexibility. Implicitly, India has, and Brazil considered, but those are the only countries that have done this explicitly thus far. But one of the reasons I wanted to shine a light on that part of the history is to flag this opportunity. It's a big one because it, among other things, would give developing countries a capacity to limit sharply Me Too drugs, meaning evergreening of patent protection for pharmaceutical products by extending the effective term. That's what India did with Gleevec, and that's what Brazil was thinking of doing. So now, enablement is even more unknown. So with respect to inventive step, India and Brazil have considered it, but no one, so far as I know, has addressed the ambiguity of enablement. So here, if you go back to the original principle of enablement, which is it implements the quid pro quo of patent law. We give you a monopoly for 20 years over your new technology, and in return, you give us, the public at large, the information concerning how to practice it. So as soon as the as soon as the patent's over, anybody can use it. And while the patent is still in effect, people can learn from the revealed technological information. That's the underlying idea of enablement that's very incompletely respected nowadays. So you could, a developing country interested in maximizing its ability to respond to health crises, could give effect to the original understanding of enablement, which in the context of pharmaceutical products would have the effect of either fleshing out more know-how or discouraging pharmaceutical firms from seeking patent protection in the country in question, and thereby leaving the field open for sophisticated generics. Either one would be beneficial. Now, I don't want to offer this as a panacea. There are no panaceas in this area, no silver bullets. Nothing is perfect. And in particular, the weakness of this particular maneuver is if the response of a pharmaceutical firm is to say, well, if that's your requirement, we're just not going to seek patent protection, then this is only a helpful maneuver if the country in question has generic firms with a technological capacity to engage in reverse engineering. So, on this issue, so here's a plug. Last night uploaded to the website the recorded interview I did with Martin Fried, who's the head of vaccine research at the Global Health Organization. And he's very knowledgeable on these issues. And one dimension is of his reflections, it concerns access to technological know-how. And on the one hand, he emphasizes how important and problematic this is. But on the other hand, he heads the WHO's role in the mRNA vaccine initiative in Africa, which is reverse engineering the technology. So ruminations about both the problematic aspect and the opportunities are offered in his recorded lectures. I encourage you to go listen to it. Whew, all right, that was the first of your three questions. I'll be briefer as to the others. As to number two, number two is a specific question about the United States. The power to create patents in the United States is grounded in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of the Constitution, which gives Congress the authority to create patents for limited times. The Takings Clause is a part of the Fifth Amendment, which was adopted after the original Constitution and has been interpreted by the Supreme Court to limit the scope of Congress's flexibility with respect to, well, lots of things, but including intellectual property rights. And so the need when adjusting the patent systems in the United States to be mindful of the Fifth Amendment is now clear here. There are not many cases on this issue. The reason there are not many cases on this issue is that it's very unusual for Congress to back down. Almost always the ratchet moves in the other direction. And so retroactive changes of the law are rare, and therefore interpretation of the Constitution is rare. As to traditional knowledge, you asked my own view. My own view, which I wrote up in a couple of different publications, you can see on my website if you're curious, is that the best solution to this issue would be, now this is going to seem odd, but I'll just state it and then read some more if you want. The TRIPS agreement should be amended to require each country in the World Trade Organization to recognize as a defense to patent infringement. Technically, the defense is inequitable conduct, you may remember from week 6, that the material in question was derived in violation of a national resources law. So the adoption of such a rule would create so-called private attorneys general, meaning that any challenger to a patent could assert, in addition to a non-obviousness challenge or a novelty challenge, that the raw materials or information employed to generate the product in question was extracted in violation of, say, the law of Colombia or the law of Brazil. That change would create the best lever in the hands of the developing countries. What it would do, it was just increase their capacity to bargain for benefits. Is this going to happen? Nope, definitely will not happen. But you asked for my view concerning what would be the best solution. That's my view.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. Byron.
Thank you, Professor. And thank you for sharing all your knowledge. When we saw this week improving the IP as a topic for this week, I thought that you were talking about how we could reach a strengthening of the disclosure requirement. Why? Because this is a very big issue for technology transfer. And for our countries, that is one of the biggest concern to protecting patents as well here in our countries. If you were to the principles of the patent system, in the past, patent offices used to ask for a specimen to the patent applicant to receive the invention and analyze if that has enough disclose or it is enabled. But now with the written description requirement, that is not enough for us. That is not enough for us. And we have realized that this patent system have changed a lot, trying to protect patents as well as trade secrets behind. Many countries are protecting these patents, and they realize with they chat or with they talk with pharmaceutical companies, and they sustain that they need a patent protection because of the investment that they are doing behind all the research and development that they are conducting to get a patent. But that is not the basis of the patent system, because this is the protection is because they are disclosing all the information, not because of the investment that they are doing to get a patent, because we can get a patent without any investment, but creating something that could be used for everyone in the benefit of the humanity as a whole. But is not an economic right only, but it's important to have this requirement extend to strain the patent system in all countries. And I think that is a very big problem that we have. You could see in this pandemic issue that we faced, the patent waiver doesn't work for us. Why? Because we don't have the capacity building to replicate those patents or enable those patents, because any of what is stated in the written description is not useful for us to replicate those patents in our country and help our people to survive. And I would like to have more about your comments regarding these issues.
As you know, having looked at the recorded lecture for this week, I agree with you. The discussion we just had highlights, in my view, the importance of the largely neglected implicit flexibility involving enablement, which is, in my view, the most useful of the dimensions of the disclosure requirement, useful for this purpose. So now, as I suggest in the recorded lecture, one of the areas in which this is potentially most powerful concerns monoclonal antibodies. The field highlighted in the negotiation exercise last week. Why? Well, because as some scholars, including Mark Lemley in a recent paper, have emphasized, seemingly technical adjustments in the enablement doctrine have huge impacts on the ability of the developers of monoclonal antibodies to achieve commercial life. And indeed, one of the objections to the recent decisions by the Federal Circuit in the United States concerning enablement of genus claims is that they've made it harder to get effective commercial protection for monoclonal antibodies. And probably the United States Supreme Court in the pending Amgen case are going to modify enablement to make it easier to satisfy and therefore easier to obtain broad protection for monoclonal antibodies. So the first level of analysis is to observe how this dial has been turned, is in the process of being turned in the United States, and highlighting the opportunity for developing countries to turn it in the opposite direction. Now, as you point, that's step one. Step two is, as you point out, yeah, okay, that could help. On the other hand, if the response to it, to repeat, is not to apply for patent protection at all, rather than to disclose more information, then you haven't solved the problem. You've created more room for generics, but you haven't given them the power to actually implement it. So on this issue, the last 10 minutes of the recorded lecture interview with Martin Fried is about the COVID waiver. And one of the two case studies that you are likely to be discussing in your seminar this week is about the COVID waiver. And it's a difficult issue. That's one of the reasons why it's addressed in the seminars, because it's worthy of a lot of conversation. But as you will see, Martin Fried is largely in agreement with your skepticism concerning its appropriateness as a vehicle. Last thought on this score is the inquiry that you pursued last week, exploring the potential for voluntary licenses, is one of the paths to solving this problem of know-how. One of the lessons of this week is that the flexibilities can be bolted together with the bargaining power that is otherwise enjoyed by developing countries and generic firms to fashion mutually beneficial arrangements that include technology transfer. So a subtle but crucial issue here is it is almost all the literature in this area speaks of voluntary licenses and compulsory licenses as alternatives. You either do one or you do the other. And one of the things I'm trying to highlight is the degree to which they can be interdependent in terms of what is most likely to most effectively address the health needs of developing countries. It's a voluntary license. But how do you get a voluntary license? Well, you know, you try to put together a variety of sources of leverage.
Yeah, just to add something, we were the country that most granted compulsory licenses in the world. We have 10 compulsory licenses granted, but none of them have been used.
Yeah.
It's not useful for us, and we have faced that. There is a study from the Franklin Pierce IP Law Center with WIPO and the University of Ottawa that says that compulsory licenses are not useful for developing countries because just the 5% of the essential medicines are protected by patents. Just the 5%. So how you could address a public policy based on compulsory licenses if you cannot attack the real problems of the public health?
Yeah.
So that is not the panacea, as you said, using compulsory licenses. And the voluntary licenses, it's also addressing at the charity scheme. Charity scheme of the pharmaceutical companies, and we are not resolving also the problem that is at the beginning, that is how we can create capacity building for countries to begin to create something that could be used for all people, as well as you have in United States or Europe.
Yeah,
and that is the main issue, how to create or improve our capacities.
Yeah, I agree. I would add only, remember in this connection, the issue that David raised right at the beginning about regional organizations and the ways that what they can enrich the bargaining power in both the political and an economic sense of the countries in question in fashioning effective solutions. Sorry, a minute. Okay, Alexia, I think you're next on the list.
Thank you very much, Professor Fisher. I had a question regarding the patent prosecution because a few days ago, I was able to check some patent databases and found that some patents that have an earliest filing date had a notice that said that this patent is subject to a terminal disclaimer. I was looking for more information and found that a terminal disclaimer is a process by which a patent's term is shortened because it duplicates the claims of another patent, which expires sooner. So I would like you to help me to understand in a better way, what does it mean when it says that it duplicates the claims of another patent? Because the practice in my country is not in that way, but I think that in the United States, it's different.
The terminal disclaimers are commonly used when it's usually a large company, is developing a series of inventions that gradually refine a technology. And each step forward involves a sufficiently creative or inventive step that you can secure patent protection for each step forward as you advance the frontier. Under those circumstances, firms apply for lots and lots of patents, one after another, and before the earlier patents have expired. there's this general principle in patent law that you can't, double patenting is not allowed. And what that means is you can't assert claims in two different patents over the same technology. Now, what's exactly the same technology? Well, that's often not apparent. There will be arguments about it. But one way of minimizing that is to disclaim in one patent technology covered in another one. And a terminal disclaimer can put a time limit on that. So that's the way it works. It's really only relevant in circumstances in which you get a, as I say, families of patents that are being sought by a single company, and they're trying to manage the portfolio in a way just to avoid the double patenting problem.
Okay, thank you very much for your information, Professor.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Okay, appears no. So we'll wrap up for the week. And I very much hope that you find engaging the seminars this week. So this is really where the rubber meets the road of the closest connection between the details of patent law and the global health crisis. So look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Have a great day. Have a great
day. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor.
You, Professor.
Thank you.